Hello, everyone. This is the Context Matters podcast, and I am your host, Cindy Parker. I am an educator, explorer, writer, and speaker. I enjoy gathering around the table with interesting people who have different life experiences from me. And then we talk about God, Bible, theology, and sometimes other tangentially related subjects. Your voice is always welcome around this table. Please reach out to me through my Narrative of Place website. We spent the last few weeks talking about Genesis and Exodus, everything from the conversations around the creation narratives and evolution to a more accurate understanding of what it means to bear God's name. This week, I wanted to get back into some of those problematic issues in the Old Testament, namely violence. Of all the problems people tell me they have with the Old Testament, on the top five is the issue of violence. Why is God so angry? Why do God's people go around killing other people? I imagine you are familiar with these kinds of questions and maybe even ask them yourself. So I invited my friend Dr. Lawson Stone to join us. He is a professor of Old Testament at Asbury Seminary, and he has expertise in early Israelite history and religion. You may remember him from season one of Context Matters, when we chatted about what land and archaeology have to do with the Bible. I love chatting with Lawson, and I know he has written a commentary on Judges, which is a book that basically forces you to deal with issues of violence in the Bible. So he is perfect for helping us through this quagmire. I know I usually ask people to start by explaining their religious context growing up, but Lawson already told us that powerful story in the very first interview. So this week, I jump straight into the reason why I called him up, and it has something to do with the fact that he told me about a book he wants to write.
I'm thinking about the title being the boring question, what do we do about violence in the Old Testament? But I want what violence really big. What violence? Because yeah. I hate to say it, but one of the things I'm going to argue is that much of the problem of violence in the Old Testament is a modern construct, and it's not an ancient problem. And that is not going to be a popular argument, because people will say, well, he's so far right, he's in denial. Or on the conservative side, they'll say, well, he's denying the historicity. There are actually people, I've talked to them in our evangelical world, who love the idea of annihilating the Canaanites, because it shows the sternness of God's judgment on their wickedness. And I've never been impressed with that argument. I mean, sure, God judges the wicked. I mean, I believe in hell. You know, if you believe in hell, what's the problem with the conquest? So creeping underneath a lot of the problems about violence is a kind of covert universalism. Yeah. And so there's all kind of interesting stuff that goes on in this discussion. But the other thing, though, there's a lot of the language there that is hyperbolic and was known to be so at the time that it was written and was understood by the readers to be so, and is even demonstrably so in the text itself. And this is simple exegesis. And the number of people who are trying to make a lot of money on the problem of violence by writing books with scandalous titles, you know, God behaving badly, or is God a moral monster, you know, this kind of stuff. I think that they are exploiting something in a way that I consider irresponsible. And I think, you know, what needs to be done is just decent historical textual exegesis.
Yeah.
And that is what I'm going to try to do. And yeah, this is under contract with Baker.
I wanted to talk about this issue because it still is a question that is alive and well, beyond all the clickbait titles that you were talking about, but there is a lot of confusion.
Well, and one of the things that I'm going to work on in the little book is there's all kinds of violence in the Bible that is not problematic. You know, just narratives of people who just do awful things. That's just par for the course. The real problem with violence tends to turn on the settlement period. And so that's Joshua, Judges. And so I've written one commentary on Judges. I'm writing another commentary on Joshua for Erdman's. And I'm hoping the exegetical work in those two volumes will provide a legitimacy, you know, for what I say in a more popular context in the little book. But the thing that I think you'll see is Joshua and Judges both figure violence, but they're both very different kinds of violence. And so I call Joshua by the old-fashioned word holy war, and this is war that God declares, and God is the primary combatant. That is, God is understood as defeating the enemy. And so, like, if you want to use Joshua as a model for warfare, then number one, you've got to believe God told you to do this. And number two, you can't have weapons or strategy or maps or bombs or planes. You just stand there and walk around places and walls fall down. That's the Joshua pattern. And so that doesn't make much of a plan, as far as I can see, for actual, you know, battle. I mean, you're not going to learn a lot about violence from that. Judges is about human beings who think God has told them to go out and engage in war. I call that hero war. And so the role of the heroes in Judges puts the violence in a somewhat different context. And the divine mandate issue in it is a different texture in the two books. And so in this little book I'm doing, and it won't be a big book, and I don't want it to be a heavy book. It's going to be really split up into saying, you know, the general parameters of good interpretation, and then how do we deal with warfare in Joshua? How do we understand it? And then the warfare in Judges. What's up with that? And I will have a chapter on that horrible final story in Judges, where the worst violence, I think, in the entire Old Testament is perpetrated by the people of God on themselves. That, I think, is going to be a somewhat different take. So anyway, it's an interesting project. It's one I've been puzzling over. And the temptation is to go read all those other books and do a big literature review. But most readers don't want to hear that. You know, that's something we do looking over our shoulder at the SBL or something. So I'm probably not going to try to interact with other people's arguments. I'm just going to put my stuff out there and see what people think.
I'm glad you mentioned both Joshua and Judges, because those are the books I wanted to focus on. And when I think of Joshua and Judges, I always think of you. And not because of the violence, but because you have this hunger for the land and for archaeology, and it took you into challenging subjects like Joshua and Judges. And so I kind of want to approach this question of violence in the way that you've ended up approaching it, which is through the land, through history, through human remains in the form of archaeology. And I kind of, can you set the stage before we even get to Joshua, or right as we're getting to Joshua, can you set the stage for us in terms of the Israelites have been in the wilderness? And I just had a conversation with Tremper Longman about, is the Exodus event a real event or a fictitious event? And what does it do to our theology? So let's go with his conclusion that the Exodus event is a historic event. But if we say during that time, the Exodus event, the Israelites are receiving the 10 words or the 10 commandments, and one of them is do not commit murder. And then right afterwards, it's go into the land and kill all these people, is how the plain reading of the text goes. So can you help us? Let's put Joshua and the Israelites right outside the border of the land. What are we looking at here in terms of this killing the inhabitants of the land and holding that in tandem with the Torah, the good laws of living well that God has given to his people?
Yeah, well, in the Old Testament, the commandment, you shall not commit murder, and that is the word, it's murder, it's not kill. A nation can believe in capital punishment and be against murder at the same time. Murder is the taking of a life without any authorization or any demonstrable reason why it's important. So, you know, you stone an Achan because he broke the laws of the harem, and 31 body bags came home from a battle of men who had no idea why they died. That the reason they died was that a guy had a Louis Vuitton coat, you know, buried in his tent that he shouldn't have. And so they all died. Their wives don't have husbands. Their children don't have fathers because Achan was greedy. And so the text, you know, authorizes the killing of Achan. That doesn't conflict with don't commit murder. The murder, homicide is the taking of a life by someone who has no authorization from the community of any kind. They are not the designated authority in the community. There's been no community process determining what should be done. There's been no divine authorization. And so murder isn't just taking a life. It is taking a life in which you assume that you and you alone have the right to decide that this person dies for your convenience. But, you know, juridical killing, capital punishment, has to do with a legitimate process and an authorizing community. And it's typically hard to do. You know, there's stuff that has to happen. And there's also the issue of God's involvement and God's authorization. I think it's important that with the conquest then, and this is what's problematic for people, we do have God saying, you know, this is a military action that I'm authorizing. And so there's not a problem with the commandment. The real problem is more related, I think, to what the word people like to throw around now is genocide. Is the conquest genocide? And it creeps me out here that there's a whole commentary now predicated on seeing Joshua as genocide. And they go with the United Nations Pact or something on definition of genocide. And normally genocide is thought of in terms of an ethnic group or a nationality, but most of the people groups mentioned in Joshua are not really races. I mean, race is a modern idea. You know, in late Bronze Age and Iron Age Levant, everybody had the same skin color. They had pretty much the same genotype. You know, they spoke mutually intelligible languages, you know, Northwest Semitic, you know, Phoenician, whatever, but they, you know, they could swap the alphabet around, you know. And so there wasn't this sense of killing off the other, you know, that you hear people say, because you couldn't look at a Israelite and a Canaanite and know if one was one or the other, unless they wore t-shirts or something. But anyway, those ethnic terms in the Old Testament tend to be affiliative. And so Canaanite, Canaan was the name of the Holy Land understood as an Egyptian province, managed by Egypt, occupied by Egypt, serving Egyptian policy. And a Canaanite could have been understood as anybody who was a beneficiary of that system. So you could be a Canaanite and be other things too. And so Brendan Benz, in his book, The Land Before the Kingdoms of Israel, points out that ethnic identities were multiple in the ancient world. You could belong to interlocking communities. And so you could still be whatever the Gibeonites were. And then, but now you're an Israelite because you belong to the Israelite coalition. Israel isn't a bloodline. It's a coalition. It's an alliance of people who are involved in one. And so then Amorite, well, we know in the late Bronze Age, the word Amorite is a reference to the polity that lived up in Lebanon, the kingdom of Amuru, and some really interesting guys up there, by the way, who are known as Apiru, and they're pushing their influence into the south, and they are intimidating towns into joining them. They are in treaty relationships with Egypt and the Hittites at the same time, which is a good trick. And so an Amorite, you know, that's a political designation. A Girgashite, there's a group of people. Nobody knows who the Girgashites were. So this is my little thing I toss into it. In Ramses II's Kadesh inscription, he mentions being assisted by some folks whose hieroglyphic name could be understood as Girgashite. And so apparently some of them just hung around in the area. And so, you know, some of these words have to do with mode of life. So when you finally go through Canaanites, Amorites, Perizzites, Girgashites, all these ites. That gentilic ending is not so much about descent as it is about affiliation. And so what you've got here is the mentioning of various kinds of organizations that have to be defeated for Israel to make good on its claim of the land. And a lot of these folks are not even from there. The Amorites, Amuru is from Lebanon. Canaan always invokes the hegemony of the Egyptians.
There are just so many important things in what Lawson is saying that we simply don't talk about in a church context. This is the full historical context behind the text we read, but we have to dig a lot to find it and to make sense of it. And as Lawson pointed out, we cannot help but bring our own modern ideas of race into our interpretation of the Bible unless we are very careful. And I love that he brought out how the land works, because I notice this all the time. We read the Bible focused on a people group written from their perspective. So we read them as a primary player on the world stage, but that is not at all correct. This is where the land helps us out. It tells us that it functioned like a bridge between empires. And like most bridges, it is somewhat uncomfortable to live on permanently and never provides the resources you need to be a big empire. You just have to figure out how to deal with those traveling through your space, pushing you around. So I really like how Dr. Stone brings out that the Egyptians are still the power structure controlling things. And just listen to this statement. It's brilliant.
And so the conquest is sort of like the Exodus part two. You know, you whip Pharaoh in Egypt, then you whip him again in Canaan. The other thing people forget, and this is iffy, all right? This is a little bit, but the Israelites had a covenant with the people of Shechem, a treaty. Now, it was fraught with conflict, to be sure. I mean, there was a lot of conflict over that treaty, but nevertheless, in the ancient world, a treaty is a treaty. And I don't know how long they would have honored it, but we don't find in Joshua that there's any conflict in Manasseh or Ephraim. They travel all the way up to Shechem and Ebal and Gerizim unmolested, conduct a highly public ceremony that essentially declares that this is Yahweh's land as opposed to Pharaoh's. And then they go back unmolested. Then when they do the northern campaign, again, they traipse up there through the area around Shechem. Clearly, you know, there must have been either the place was not very well inhabited, which is possible, or everybody understood the Israelites to have legitimate rights to being present there. And I think both of those things is true. So when we start taking apart the historical context of the settlement, it is not quite as simple as European explorers landing in North America and annihilating the indigenous population. Even the word indigenous. Now, in North America, the people we refer to as Native Americans, you should put Americans in quotes because they were here long before anybody even thought of America. But they've got 10, 15,000 years of residency. Most of the people in Canaan, you know this. What do we call Canaan? The land between. It's a giant intersection where people eventually just stayed. And I don't know that you can speak of an indigenous population in Canaan in the late Bronze Age. The demographic movements are so complex. Trade is complex. Political domination is. So I live in Kentucky, and the early name for Kentucky was Dark and Bloody Ground. And it's because nobody had a legitimate claim to Kentucky. And so all the Native American tribes fought over it. And eventually came to decide that it didn't belong to anybody. And it was because it was in this gap between the country in Ohio and Indiana with its particular characteristics and Appalachia and the Appalachian Mountains in the south. So Kentucky's kind of like right in the middle, sort of like the way Canaan was. It was a passage area. So I don't know that we can legitimately speak of indigenous population in Canaan. But if you look at There's one commentary on Judges that I'm working at now that on the average has the word indigenous two times per page. And I want to tell him, you know, look, there are not a lot of people in Canaan. Canaan was a beautiful, strange, interesting inflow of all kind of different people. And the Israelites didn't have as much right to claim a place there as anybody. Also, I like to point out the Israelites seem to be the only people who actually just wanted to farm. The Egyptians wanted to extract, you know, agriculture and have a buffer between them and the Hittites. The kingdom of Amuru wanted Canaan for their reasons. Everybody, you know, wanted it for some reason that was related to some other place. And the Israelites are just, you know, they just want to farm. And, you know, they might be one of the few groups that actually just wanted to see the land thrive. The only two groups I consider, well, I shouldn't say only two. The two groups I tend, or actually three, to think of when I think of indigenous people are indigenous Native Americans, Australia. There's an indigenous population in Australia that, again, has about 10,000 years worth of history. And then, of course, sub-Saharan Africa. You have thousands and thousands and thousands where the gene pool is actually bounded. And so, you know, you've got these genetic studies to find out, you know, who's who, you know, in the ancient world. I just want to say good luck with that. But they weren't really that careful about such things. And so these genealogies are much more about histories of affiliation than they are about bloodlines, which is a more modern kind of racial notion. Anyway, I've been rambling. So all that to me just makes it so complicated. And none of us likes our statements of moral censure to be complicated. We want to just say, it's genocide, it's awful, but it's not that simple. It never is.
And it's really helpful. I really like the way that you framed it in terms of coalitions of people, even saying mm-hmm. the Israelites as a coalition of people. In the scholarly world, as you know, people are looking at the archaeological remains and saying, is the conquest narrative historical? Which mm-hmm. brings up lots of questions in terms of how are we understanding the conquest narrative? And then there's the whole conclusion that there was never a conquest. It was just the banding together of people who lived in the lands and calling yeah. themselves one people group. But it's interesting to think about it the way that you set it up in terms of it's both of those things. It's a coalition of tribes coming out of an exodus, going into a land where there's a coalition, various coalitions of people.
Yeah. And some of them ally with them, the Gibeonites, Rahab. You know, at the end of chapter 8 at Ebal is this interesting little sleeper comment where it says they set up the Ark and Austin. It says all Israel stood before them, the native born and the foreigner. So notice Israel equals native born plus foreigner. And then you've got the Gibeonites. You've got, and then in chapter 24, you know, the two endings in Joshua, chapter 23, Joshua is clearly speaking to kind of the core group, says mission accomplished. You guys did great. Keep it going. Then in 24, he challenges these people to put aside the gods they serve beyond the river and all this stuff. Well, this is the paradigmatic conquest generation that didn't do any of that stuff. So who's he talking to? And I think he's talking to the people who affiliated with Israel during the initial years of consolidation, but who've never really brought themselves under the covenant with Yahweh. And so Joshua, this is like the swearing in. You know, this is Ellis Island. This is when they become naturalized Israelites, to use a metaphor only. But so I think that's what's going on in chapter 24. And what's amazing there is Joshua breaks out here a whole concept of nationhood that is mind-blowing. That is, it exploits the unity of racial ethnic language, but it does so in forging what amounts to what we would call a multi-ethnic community. And this community is held together by its devotion to Yahweh and his code of conduct and a mutual devotion one to another. And it's the covenant that defines Israel, not the genetic code. And what did Jesus say? God can raise up children of Abraham from rocks, okay? Rocks. That's how fancy you people are, rocks. And Jesus said, my true relatives, my mother and brother and sisters are those who know the will of God and do it. And Jesus is speaking, I think, very much in concert with the Joshua 24 material and the hints that we get all through the book of Joshua that the harem is actually pretty porous and that the definition of who gets killed and who doesn't, you know, is not quite what we expect. The other thing about when you think of all this mass, you know, you read about the blood-soaked pages of Joshua and burning cities everywhere. You know, most archaeologists don't think that there was 75,000 people in Canaan at all when the Israelites arrived. I mean, your highlands were largely depopulated. The urban centers were really on the ropes, and they were mainly occupied by kings appointed by the Egyptians and defended by mercenaries. And so you're not looking at masses of people. And the text even clearly tells us that the Israelites did not, in fact, actually burn down very many cities. It set some of them on fire, but that doesn't mean burned them to the ground. You know, they set Lachish on fire. Fine. You know, you do archaeology at Lachish, you may not find a destruction layer, or you might, but you'll probably find where somebody torched something. And at Megiddo, interesting at Megiddo, one of the destruction layers at Megiddo, the excavator says, seems to have only been targeted at elite residences and seems to have been the action of a rowdy band of locals. And, you know, you kind of wonder, well, I wonder what rowdy band of locals that might have been. So, you know, Jericho and Ai and Hazor look like, you know, the only real candidates for that. And one wonders.
The only candidates, just for clarification, the only candidates for being fully burned. Yeah.
Yeah, fully burned. That is where we might expect to find an actual destruction layer. And we find that, of course, at Hazor. And, you know, there's all kind of problems with Jericho and Ai. You know, we got to own that. On the other hand, if Jericho at the time of Joshua wasn't much of a town, then we might not find much of a destruction layer because it may have been daunting to the Israelites. But let's face it, these were not the sharpest knives in the drawer when it came to military operations. Okay. The Israelites, these are people that every time they won a battle, they had to say it was a miracle. Now that tells you right off that we're not looking at SEAL Team 6 here. Okay. We're not even looking at SEAL Team 1.2. We're not looking at the Marines. We're sort of looking at the what's that? The bobsled team from the Bahamas, you know, or something that nobody had any. That's kind of what the Israelites, they're the underdogs. They're going up against cities with Egyptian sponsorship, Egyptian training, money, equipment, chariots, armor. And where do the Israelites get their weapons? They pick them up off the ground or wherever. And so, you know, they're absolute incompetence when it comes to the military stuff. And so for them to say, see that city, we're going to take it. And everybody goes, and what are you smoking? Nobody goes, yeah, we can do that. It's they did that at Ai and look what happened. So there are people who look at the enemy and think, we're going to die this time. I just know it. This is it. I mean, we were lucky at Jericho. Not so lucky at Ai, but okay. But now I don't know how we're going to do this. So they're going up against the Egyptian system of running Canaan. Yeah. And it's puts them in a really scary place.
Yeah.
So, you know, those battles look a lot
really interesting. Yeah. It brings up an interesting concept in thinking of them as not being fully trained army people. Does it make it worse than to think they win because of God? Does it put God in the position of doing more violence than his people?
Well, when we, you know, I can see it could be constructed that way. What's fascinating to me is none of the early Christian commentators on Joshua in the first three or four centuries ever notices that, ever says much about that. And partly because these guys had seen a Roman legion in action, for example, and that was their baseline on violence. And so they're looking at a bunch of escaped slaves and farmers coming in out of the desert and thinking, you know, it probably looked very different to them. But also the early Christian interpreters believed that God had a right to judge the world and God had a right to assert the claims of his people. But also we have to recall too, this is a situation where in the conquest, and I say conquest, the word conquest does not appear in the book of Joshua. The Old Testament never characterizes it as a conquest, which I find really interesting that we do.
When did we even start? Now that you're saying that, I'm like, oh, it's always been called conquest. Where does it come from? Do you know where that historic?
I've not dug around on that. But all the verbs that I find, I mean, there's the verb to take or capture. There's the verb yarash, of course, to possess. There's the whole inheritance group of terminology. Even harem, you know, the horrible harem word, is really only Joshua like 2 through 11. It's not a term that gets scattered through the whole book. In fact, I see the first half of the book as harem. The second half of the book is inheritance. And then the last two or three chapters are witness. The word aid is the kind of thread that holds them together. So conquest is a misnomer.
This is not the end of the conversation. Join me next week as Dr. Stone and I talk about the Hebrew term harem, after which we compare the relatively mild recording of violence in the Bible compared to the grossly explicit violence recorded by other people groups. Good times, right? Seriously, though, you'll be fascinated. While you wait for the next episode to drop, you may be interested in watching Dr. Lawson Stone's videos that he has about violence in the Old Testament that are on Seedbed's 7-Minute Seminary. I'll put a link in the show notes. Thank you for being here, and thank you to my brilliant team on Patreon. People like Tammy O'Banion, Linda Overall, Carol Lloyd. They are not just a huge support to me, but they're also the ones who make this podcast sustainable. We would not be in this season without their help. If you want to help support this podcast and get special things like spices from Israel or first copies of articles I'm writing and publishing, you can join the team. The link is in the episode notes. But you can also do very simple things like post a link on your social media pages and invite friends and family to join us all here at the podcast table. I produced and edited this podcast. Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created the music, and Luke Bronner of Milieu Media Group did the final mix. I look forward to our conversation next week. Until then, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.